Third case on today's calendar, 25-2652, Petróleos de Venezuela S.A. et al. Versus MUFG Union Bank N.A. et al. Good morning, I understand, Mr. Gottlieb. So the counsel for the appellants, I understand you're going to split argument half and half, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Mr. Gottlieb goes first, and then Mr., is it Timofeyev goes next? And then for the appellee, we will have Attorney Hansford, right? Okay, and you've got it all?
Got it all.
All right, well, I hope you brought a bottle of water. we will then allow each of the appellant's lawyers, you'll have 2 minutes apiece for rebuttal. Okay, but we are, just to warn you, just because you're splitting it in the aggregate, you're not gonna, as a practical matter, get any more than the other side. So you're gonna need to be attentive to the clock there. Before we do actually start the arguing and before we run the clock, would you just articulate for the court so we keep track which issues each of you has divvied up so we know the order of events?
Sure thing. I will be handling the comity and active state issues, and Mr. Timofeyev will be handling the merits of the Venezuelan law issues.
Okay, very good. Thank you. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Mike Gottlieb representing appellant PDV Holding. Articles 150 and 187.9 of the Venezuelan Constitution hold that any national public interest contract must be approved by the Venezuelan National Assembly. The party's dispute boils down to whether the National Assembly's approval authority covers contracts executed by PDVSA, Venezuela's state-owned national oil company, or whether that approval authority is limited to only contracts in which the national executive is a party. Over half a decade of litigation, the Republic has made 5 submissions in U.S. courts, offering a patient, clear, thorough, and authoritative interpretation of Venezuelan law. Like the Chinese Ministry of Commerce in the vitamin C litigation, the Republic has explained a feature of Venezuela's constitution that may not be obvious to U.S. courts. In Venezuela's constitutional system, PDVSA is more than just a state-owned entity. PDVSA's responsibility over the lifeblood of Venezuela's economy means that many PDVSA's contracts directly implicate Venezuela's national economic interests. That interpretation is rooted in practice. For decades, the National Assembly has reviewed and approved PDVSA contracts under Article 150 and 187.9, even where the national executive is not a party. The district court rejected the Republic's interpretation of its own constitution.
Can I just ask a question about that? Are there examples prior to 2017 of the National Assembly being asked to approve contracts pursuant to which PDVSA committed itself to substantial debt?
So the debt, their debt contracts, there would not be an example of that for 2 reasons. There are examples prior to 2017 of PDVSA contracts being submitted to the National Assembly for approval by the National Executive. Those are cited in Brewer's supplemental report, which is at pages 3595 to 97 of the special appendix. With respect to the debt contracts, the reason that there wouldn't have been is because prior to this transaction, and this is explained in Ambassador Vecchio's letter and in the Republic's briefs, but prior to this transaction, PDVSA had never attempted to encumber a foreign asset as collateral in the issuance of a debt agreement, and many of the debt agreements would not have been subject to the constitutional restriction in Article 150 anyway, because they wouldn't have been contracts with foreign counterparties or with foreign states.
Well, but some of them were. And so I'm trying to, I'm thinking through the significance of providing security. Certainly, if PDVSA got out over its skis on debt, its foreign held assets would be vulnerable to collection regardless of whether they had been specifically pledged. It interposed a few more steps for the creditors to collect it, but Am I wrong about that?
That doesn't necessarily mean that the contract would implicate the provision in Article 150 to qualify as a national public interest contract. And I think part of the issue here is, first, that we are now splitting hairs over the scenarios in which the National Assembly chooses to assert its powers over a contract. There's no question that in this case the National Assembly did choose to assert its approval authority over the contract. And what the way we get into an active state doctrine problem is by starting to ask, well, did the National Assembly apply that approval authority consistently over time? Do we feel like they've adopted a consistent practice?
So let me, and maybe I'm misunderstanding sort of how the two issues relate to one another. This is helpful to understand, because when you said you were going to argue active state, and then it seemed like you started on the underlying question of whether approval is required. If approval isn't required, isn't that the scenario in which we get to your active state argument? Or is your active state argument that if approval is required, then the active state doctrine sort of tells us that the approval was denied, and if approval is not required, you lose all around? Is that sort of where we land?
I think the court should begin with the active state question, because the active state question asks, is there an act of the sovereign that supplies a rule of decision in this case?
Didn't we kind of suggest last time around that maybe it should be flipped, that we should, before we resort to the active state, we should figure out what the governing law is and whether or not approval of the National Assembly was required for this contract?
This court can, of course, take the issues in whichever order it chooses. Under the Celestins case and under Sabatino and cases like it, what the active state doctrine does is it supplies a rule of decision for the case. And so if you're looking to see, is there a rule of decision that we apply to the question of, were the bonds valid when issued, which is the issue that the district court was supposed to consider on remand from the New York Court of Appeals. Were these bonds valid as a matter of Venezuelan law when issued? If there is a rule of decision that applies to it, there's no need for this court to wade into the merits of Venezuelan law at all, because the rule of decision is supplied, and we think the rule of decision is supplied by the sovereign acts under cases like Celestin and under cases like Sabatino.
But how do we understand the significance of what the National Assembly did if we don't understand what the legal framework is and what authority it didn't have under sort of underlying Venezuelan law? I guess I'm struggling with that.
So under a long line of cases, the relevant question under the active state doctrine is, what was the sovereign purporting to do? That's the language that this court quoted in its 2022 certification opinion. That's from Celestins. That's from Kirkpatrick and other cases that follow it. You don't ask what did the foreign sovereign legally accomplish. You ask, what were they trying to do? What were they claiming to do? This court has already essentially recognized what the National Assembly was purporting to do.
What were they purporting to do?
They were purporting, according to this court's certification opinion in 2022, which we agree with, they were purporting to assert their constitutional authority over the exchange. And they were rejecting the pledge and rejecting the transaction in the course of asserting its constitutional authority over the exchange.
So your argument is, if that's what they were purporting to do, then it doesn't matter whether in fact they had such constitutional authority, because their assertion of that authority under the active state doctrine creates the authority. Is that what I'm understanding?
It's more than that, Your Honor. It's not
okay.
Just that. It's that once you understand what they were purporting to do or what authorities they were asserting, you cannot examine whether that was consistent with Venezuelan law. That is the precise holding of Banco de España. That is the precise holding of Sabatino. That is exactly the point of the active state doctrine. When it is made to appear that the foreign sovereign has acted in a certain capacity, that's the language from Ricaud. When it is made to appear that the sovereign has acted in a certain capacity, you don't then ask, well, did they comply with all of the requirements of their own country's constitution? In Banco de España, for example, it was a secret decree that the ambassador from Spain provided to the United States court. The court didn't ask the question, did that decree get promulgated correctly? Was that decree consistent with other elements of Spanish law? It was simply the fact that the decree conferred title to the silver that moved the court. The same is.
So let me ask then, because one of the things we talk about is, does the purported act operate extraterritorially. So my question is, the 2017 bonds, where were they to be brought for the purpose of the exchange?
I actually don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I don't think it matters for purposes of determining the Sovereign Act here.
Okay, well, no, let me push on that a little bit. If it turns out that the record tells us that the exchange that was the subject of the National Assembly resolution in 2017 was the presentation of bonds that matured in 2017 in New York City to exchange for 2020 notes that would themselves live in New York City, why isn't that an entirely extraterritorial transaction?
Okay, I understand the question. I thought you were asking me solely about the 2017 bonds on their own terms. The exchange was meant to be an exchange that contemplated acts in New York. We don't dispute that. The exchange would have involved contracts under New York law, payments under New York law. That's not in dispute. The legal question before the court, and this is controlled by the New York Court of Appeals definition of 8110 validity, is were the bonds or the securities valid when issued, or was there a defect by virtue of the National Assembly's lack of approval that rendered them invalid when issued?
But they were issued here.
The issuance occurred, the approval occurred in Caracas in Venezuela. And the lack of the National Assembly's approval authority, the lack of authority that provides the defect for the bond, is entirely an issue of Venezuelan law. No one disputes that. And it is entirely an issue, and is entirely an issue that incurred between governmental entities in Venezuela.
How do we figure out the situs of the issuance? It's kind of an interesting question. Is it when the piece of paper that documents the bond is generated, that's the issuance, or when it's presented to someone else? It can't be that when somebody has the idea that they're going to issue bonds, it's being issued in the place where they had the idea. There's something that happens when you issue bonds.
That may be true, but the defect present in the vehicle, in the defect that's present in the security, is the absence of approval.
Well, we're in a circle, though, right? If the absence of approval is a defect as a matter of Venezuelan law, that's a question that I think we're going to be talking about with your colleague. But if the defect purportedly arises as a result of an act of state, then we have to ask the question, does that act of state purport to operate extraterritorially? And that brings us to New York. And that's why I'm struggling with hearing from you first.
So the instruction that is the instruction of the September resolution is an instruction that, if it is effective, occurs entirely within Venezuela. The instruction of the September resolution is effectively, you may not issue this debt. It is an instruction to PDVSA. It is a command from the National Assembly that says, we reject your proposal for the refinancing of debt. You may not do so. That, if it is effective, it's effective because it occurs in Venezuela and it deprives PDVSA of the legal authority under Venezuelan law of moving forward with the transaction and issuing the debt, and it means that the bonds were invalid when issued. I don't think it matters under the act of state doctrine whether there is one component of that that might occur in New York. And the reason I don't think it matters is because in cases like, for example, Sabatino involved the expropriation of sugar that's sitting at the port outside of Cuba, but ultimately involved a dispute over payment between entities based in New York. And that it was a dispute about whether one entity could repay another entity in funds that were being held by a receiver in New York State Court. The fact that there's a spillover effect into the United States doesn't answer the question of whether the expropriation of sugar...
Yeah, but the sugar was sitting in Cuba.
That's right, but the...
What's sitting in Venezuela?
What's sitting in Venezuela at the time of the national...
What's the so-called sugar?
What's sitting there is the authority to issue the debt. It's the legal authority to commit PDVSA to a repayment obligation.
I guess I don't see the analogy.
Well, it's because if there is a debt...
If the sugar was sitting in New York in Sabatino, would you say, yeah, but the authority to sell the sugar was in Cuba?
No,
it would have come out the same way. No, I'm serious. What's the thing?
The point is
that if it's an extraterritorial taking,
there is no taking in this case. That's
or extraterritorial action.
Our argument.
I guess I'm not following your analogy.
Our argument is that there is no extraterritorial act or taking in this case. If the act is effective, it's effective because it incurred entirely within Venezuela, and what it did is it deprived PDVSA of the legal authority to move forward with authorization to engage in the transaction? And that is the precise question that is at issue under Section 8110 of validity in this case.
So I think we've worked through some of the actus. Yeah. Do you have some further questions?
I have, just one sort of bookkeeping, I've read your 28J letter about the consequences of the change in administration, but I just am trying to understand, has the new administration weighed in at all on Venezuela's position in this?
There has been no weigh-in or change in position that the Republic has taken in this case.
Okay, and then the other question I had is, through much of this litigation, there was the U.S.-recognized Guaido-appointed PDVSA board, and then I understand there was sort of a parallel Maduro-appointed board. What's the status now? Does PDVSA have two boards, or does it have one board, and how what does that look like?
Well, for purpose of this case, there is one PDVSA, and it is represented by my colleague here, Mr. Timofeyev. There's been no change of any kind that has been put on the docket or is in the record of this case. You have seen in some litigation motions to intervene or substitute parties. That has not occurred in this case, and so on the record before us, the issue is simply not presented.
All right, why don't we turn to your colleague and let's hear about some of the other ones, the Venezuelan law, whatever is with your ambit, within the ambit of your arguments.
Thank you, Honor, and may it please the court. As to Venezuelan law, the issue in this case is whether Article 150 or the Venezuelan Constitution categorically requires that the national executive be a party to national public interest contract, and therefore excludes contracts by decentralized state entities. The text and purpose of Article 150 preclude this interpretation, and the Venezuelan court decisions, including Andres Velasquez, do not hold otherwise. First, as to the text, Article 150 contains two requirements. The first sentence mandates National Assembly approval for national public interest contracts where required by statute. The second sentence mandates such approval for contracts with foreign counterparties without the need for separate legislation. There is no dispute that for decades, the Venezuelan executive has submitted pursuant to Article 150's first sentence, and the National Assembly has approved joint venture contracts, including by PDVSA affiliates, where the national executive was not a party. The term national public interest contract must be read consistently throughout Article 150, and it cannot mean that contracts where the national executive is not a party qualify under the first sentence of that provision, but not under the second.
Why doesn't the distinction that you just described support the opposite inference, that if the Constitution is going to purport to require National Assembly approval for actions of entities that are part of the decentralized government, that needs to be reflected in statute. Otherwise, we're focusing on the second sentence, that's the central government. I mean, why isn't that an equally plausible sort of inference from that contrast that you've set up?
Your Honor, because the answer actually lies in Andres Velasquez, but also in the opinions of, in the comments of Venezuelan scholars, is the second sentence operates as a direct command. So if a national public interest contract, which can be done by a decentralized entity, is concluded with a foreign non-domiciled counterparty, it has to go to the National Assembly, irrespective of the separate legislation. So in Andres Velasquez, the court actually openly said, the financial law on a public administration does not require submission of credit transactions to the National Assembly. But the court in Andres Velasquez said that law cannot insulate submission of contracts of such credit transaction contracts with foreign counterparties to the National Assembly. That is a requirement that does not depend on independent legislation. It operates as a direct constitutional command. And that has been a historical feature of Venezuelan constitutional law since the early 20th century. The other point I would like to make is it's also important to consider the purpose of Article 150. and limiting the term national public interest contract only to contracts by the national executive would eviscerate and contradict that purpose. Article 150 was expressly drafted in 1999 to counter a proposal by then President Hugo Chavez, which sought to limit the scope of Article 150 and of the National Assembly approval requirement to only contracts by the national executive. The Constituent Assembly rejected that proposal, and that is in the materials of the Constituent Assembly, which you can see in Appendix 5225 or 5230.
I'm sorry, can you just back up to Andres Velasquez? I'm still having trouble seeing how you get around that.
So let me try to explain the Andres Velasquez. And there are two
essential. And focus on the language used. I don't want to hear big picture. I mean, you can use big picture too, but big picture usually obscures what the court actually said. Focus on what they said, because I sort of understood you to make a couple decisions. One, they didn't really say what the other side says they said, and even if they didn't say it, who cares? It's not really binding. The last one, I have to say, is not a particularly persuasive suggestion. But the first one, tell me why Andres Velasquez doesn't say what they say it says.
So I think there are 2 points, Your Honor. One is, if you look at the doctrinal discussion that the other side focused on, the district court did, and what Andres Velasquez discussed, what they were discussing the doctrinal discussion in the Venezuelan constitutional scholarships about the predecessor provision to Article 150, Article 126 of the 1986 Constitution. That provision used two different terms. It used the term national interest contract and national, state, or municipal public interest contract. And there's a lot of Venezuelan scholarship as to whether or not the term national interest contract, national public interest contract, was the same or different. The Constitutional Chamber, Andres Velasquez, said that discussion has been resolved by the 1999 Constitution, which only uses the term national public interest contract. That discussion, that analysis, has nothing to do with the question whether Article 150 and the national public interest contract subject to Article 150 encompass or do not encompass decentralized state entities. And when the Constitutional Chamber, Andres Velasquez, said we will specify the meaning of the term national public interest contract, it explained that this is a contract whose purpose is determinant or essential to accomplishing the purposes and objectives of the Venezuelan state. This is at page 2117 in the appendix. That is the test of Andres Velasquez, and under that test, this contract qualifies, because the potential loss of CITCO, which is a governmental asset of strategic importance in an industry where state ownership is constitutionally required in Venezuela, is certainly going to be determinant or essential to the Venezuelan state.
So you're saying strategic importance is, I guess I'm looking for what, that doesn't seem closely tied enough to what they're saying in Andres Velasquez. I mean, how do we determine what, when you're talking about national public interests, if it's not the Republic being a party to or a guarantor of whatever the transaction is? Now you're saying strategic importance? That doesn't, a lot of things could have strategic importance to the Republic. I don't know that that's, that seems too broad of an interpretation of what the case is saying.
I think, Joanna, you can look at the cases, the Constitutional Chamber's decisions that postdated Andres Velasquez.
With this one. No offense, stick with this one, because, I mean, we deal with this kind of analysis, and I know it's not perfectly analogous, looking at what the Supreme Court said, and if we got a holding, we're stuck with it, right? Regardless of, well, we think the reason for it is this, right? The reason for the holding is that, but we can't extrapolate back to the reason and ignore the holding. So stick with, identify what you say is the holding here, and I get it, it's a civil law country, it's not exactly the same adjudication, but show us the money words, the money paragraph, where you think that they crystallize the rule that is embodied in Andres Velasquez, and tell us why that key paragraph doesn't mean what they say it means.
Your Honor, the key holding is, and this is again, I think on page.
Here's the page, yeah.
It's page appendix 2117.
Yeah.
It's a rule I quoted where Chambers said, the national public interest contract is, I quote, is a contract, I quote, whose purpose is determinant or essential to accomplishing the purpose and objectives of a sovereign state. And then continued saying
you
it is
that's
a contract.
The money, it's the purpose? That's the holding there? That's the limiting language? Is that a contract that has a purpose? This goes back to Judge Lee's question. I mean, that's a contract that anybody could have. You know, you have somebody who's I don't know, a very influential business in Caracas, and they are engaging in a contract that could have strategic value to the company, to the country, because say they control some key natural resource. You wouldn't contend that because we extrapolate to this big picture that it has strategic value to Venezuela, it's covered by this, would you?
No, of course, Your Honor.
So that's why we need the more specific language.
A contract by a private Venezuelan individual will not be national public.
That's what I'm
contract.
Saying. So you're extrapolating way too far into generalities here.
I did not mean to. I think the other requirement is that it has to be a contract concluded by a national state entity, whether by an entity of a national executive, such as a ministry, or an entity of the decentralized public administration, such as state-owned company or state autonomous institute. And this is why it's important to understand how the role that these decentralized entities play in the Venezuelan governmental structure. In the Venezuelan constitutional structure, decentralized, the national executive effectuates its policy, particularly in the contracting sphere, through the decentralized entities. They are attached to a specific ministry. They act under the direction of a ministry. They are the ones that actually conclude, enter into contracts. It is quite rare that the ministry will enter directly into a contract. And that's why Venezuelan constitutional scholars, as far back as in 1961, Professor Faris Mata said, if you exclude decentralized entities from the scope of Article than 126, but from the scope of the national public interest contracts, you will allow the national executive to evade that requirement of a National Assembly approval.
But I'm sorry, the rule of law, I mean, when we have specific rules of law, you can often evade them by doing something different, right? If the letter of the law says do A, but the letter lets you do B, and that evades the purpose or the spirit of A, usually the answer is tough luck. So I guess I'm not seeing why allowing, if a process or a procedure is banned by, say, their constitution, but you can do some other process or procedure that gets you to the same endpoint. Again, the answer is, who cares?
I think the answer, Judge Nardini, is here the text of Article 150, when it refers to the National Assembly's authority to approve national public interest contracts. That power is not limited to just contracts by the national executive. It also encompasses contracts.
Right. I get that, but that's your end game, right? That's the conclusion you wish us to draw. But you can't say that must be the conclusion because anything else would allow, you know, would allow. If the Constitution limits these sorts of contracts to ones that are signed by an actual executive department, then you don't get the result that the Constitution probably wants. That seems to be the argument you're making, which is not a particularly persuasive one.
I think you look at the purpose of that provision.
No, you're going back to purpose, and you're going away from the text, the provision of what it says you can do and what Andres Velasquez says you can or can't do, as opposed to extrapolating out and saying, well, but there's some bigger purpose here, so let's broaden it.
But, Your Honor, you can look at the text of Article 150. It does not say, it does not reference national executive. It references that the National Assembly has the power to approve national public interest contracts. There is no limitation of those contracts to the national executive. And look at, again, it's important to read Andres Velasquez, a Venezuelan constitutional scholar, said, in conjunction with constitutional chamber's subsequent decisions, in Adelka a year later, and then Attorney General 2 5 years later.
I do really want to talk about those subsequent ones, but here's my question about Andres Velasquez. I grant you that the issue in that case had nothing to do with whether the decentralized public administration versus the centralized executive were subject to this. But the court did have this phrase where it said, contracts concluded by the republic through the competent organs of the national executive. That was the sort of limiting phrase, and that's been repeated in subsequent cases. We're not Venezuelan scholars, so we don't know with certainty whether that includes the decentralized public administration. But the district court put a lot of emphasis, and I think understandably so, on the fact that your own experts at a prior time were very critical of this decision precisely because they thought it purported to exclude from the scope of this requirement, the national public interest contract approval requirement, contracts for entities like PDVSA. if we think this decision, if we think, oh, that it's compelling to criticize this decision on that basis, aren't we still stuck with your expert's prior understanding that that's in fact what this did?
You know, I think our experts, what they said is they were concerned at the time that this decision could be misused.
Okay.
To mean that Andres Velasquez, the Constitutional Assembly, in fact restricted national public interest contracts in that way. And I think they were particularly concerned because at the time they were writing in 2015-17, the independence of the Supreme Judicial Tribunal was being eroded, and the judges were being replaced by the Maduro-appointed judges, many of whom the United States actually sanctioned. So I think they were concerned that
But the Andres Velasquez decision was in 2000.
It was in 2002, but I think some of the writings that our experts have where they criticized and said, look, this decision could be used to argue for restrictive interpretation, those writings came in 2015, 2017. And they were not alone. Other constitutional scholars such as Du Corridor also expressed a similar concern. Now, I do want to acknowledge there is a footnote in Professor Brewer's article from 2006 where he characterized that decision as binding. He since said that the use of the word binding was a mistake. It does not represent his view as to when the decision is binding. But that's a separate issue from whether or not they believe that that decision is up to restrictive interpretation. And other scholars, for instance, at Appendix 1807, you can look at the opinion of Professor Bedell Madrid, which explained that, and this is one of the scholars this record actually quoted, he actually explained that if you look at Andres Velasquez, that decision is limited to the question of whether contracts by the national executives entities constitute national public interest contracts, because that was the only issue before that court. And to the extent this court thinks there is some ambiguity, because we're dealing with a foreign system, these courts sometimes reason a different way than the common law courts, you can look at the opinion of the Republic, which took the similar position and explained that the issue whether or not Article 150 excluded decentralized entities was not at issue in Andres Velasquez. And then the Republic pointed to the subsequent decision in Delca and said, look, in the Delca, the Constitutional Chamber explained that what's important is that the subject matter of a contract relate directly to the national interest. That is what happened in the Delca, where the Constitutional Chamber, in fact, said that the contract entered into by a state-owned Venezuelan company for the provision of a supply of electricity is a national public interest.
Wasn't that contract the consummation of an executive-to-executive convention about provision of, can we understand that apart from that context where the Republic at the highest levels was in fact involved?
Yohana, I think it was certainly connected to the agreement between Venezuela and the Brazil for the construction of a power line in a particular region. But what the Constitutional Chamber emphasizes is that the contract between Adelca, the state-owned company, and the Brazilian company was a separate contract subject to a separate legal regime. It did effectuate the interests which were embodied in the international agreement, but I would argue that actually the Republic's interest in keeping control of Sitka is more consequential than the interest in ensuring that there is electricity supply to an electric line between Venezuela and Brazil. This court can also look at the Attorney General II decision, which was issued 5 years after Andres Velasquez. And there, the Constitutional Chamber said that a contract by a state-owned agricultural bank is a national public interest contract. The district courts said,
But the subject of that contract was to commit not just the bank, but the Republic itself to indebtedness, right? So again, it's sort of nominally conducted by a state-owned enterprise, but the consequence is to bind the Republic itself in a way that I think distinguishes something that's the state-owned enterprise acting as a private entity, essentially.
Ioana, I agree, but I think it shows that participation of a national executive as a party is not a categorical requirement for something to be a national public interest contract. And certainly, in Attorney General, the Republic made itself liable for any kind of debt that is not paid by that agricultural bank. But by the same extension, in this case, the Republic will lose control of a $16 billion company, which is of strategic importance for its oil industry.
But it's not liable, right? There's not, you can't reach beyond PDVSA to sue Venezuela for its sovereign assets in satisfaction of these bonds, right? It's a qualitatively different.
Your Honor, that is correct. But I think, again, that's when you have to look at what role PDVSA and similar companies of a decentralized public administration play in Venezuela. And there is no strict line separating the national executive in Venezuela from companies like PDVSA, which is a state-owned company. It's actually referenced in the Constitution, which mandates Venezuelan state ownership of PDVSA. So this PDVSA is, in fact, a part, it's unquestionably a part of the national public administration in Venezuela. And the loss of CITGO, which is owned by PDVSA, or any kind of other PDVSA asset which may be attached, will be a direct loss to the Republic. In Venezuelan constitutional structure, it is still viewed as directly tied to the national state interests.
Okay, I think that we have asked you quite a few questions. We've kept you up. Are there any other questions the panel has right now? Okay, we will see you back for rebuttal. Don't go away. We have Attorney Hansford for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Masha Hansford of Davis Polk for appellees, the collateral agent, and the trustee. The district court's thorough analysis of Venezuelan law has overwhelming support in multiple decisions of Venezuela's highest constitutional court in the views of scholars of Venezuelan law, including PDVSA's own experts in this case and their own prior scholarship, and an extensive body of past practice. The Constitutional Chamber's binding interpretation of the term national public interest contract in Andres Velazquez establishes, in the language that Judge Robinson referenced in my friend's argument, that the national executive itself must, rather than a state-owned company, must be a party of such a
contract. Well, it says they're competent organs, right? And so that's sort of where the ambiguity comes in. And one of the things I'm struggling with, and again, this is not being a Venezuelan lawyer, is there was nothing in that case that implicated the issue that's before us here, right? It was challenging the constitutionality of a statute that purported to let the national executive himself enter into these these transactions. Isn't the choice of language then a little bit like what we might call dicta within our own system? It's the terminology they use, but nobody was asking them to consider the question of how broad the universe is of actors that are subject to Article 150.
Judge Robinson, two responses to that. The first is, I think the concept of holding in dicta doesn't map on perfectly to the Venezuelan system, because under Article 335 of the Venezuelan Constitution, the Constitutional Chamber has supreme authority over interpretations of the Constitution, and this unequivocally is an interpretation of the Constitution. If there was any doubt about that, it actually invokes the language of Article 335. It says, proceeding as maximum and ultimate interpreter of the Constitution. This is on page 2116 of the appendix. It says, as maximum and ultimate interpreter of the Constitution, the court chooses to set out a comprehensive definition. So I do think it's binding for that reason. Even if you want to think about it in the more familiar terms of holding and dicta, you're right that this particular distinction was not at issue in Andres Velazquez, and the court could have decided the case more narrowly, but it chose not to do that. Instead, it said, the term national public interest contract has been confused. We are choosing to set out a broad rule, and it set out a broad rule that would apply to a lot of situations and then applied it to this case. Even in the U.S. system, I think that would be the ratio decidendi that would be binding if the U.S. Supreme Court, say, did the same thing.
So if we're trying to decide whether PDVSA is a competent organ of the national executive, if that's sort of what this turns on, we consider ourselves to be bound by both that case and this particular language. Given the extensive interconnection between PDVSA and a state-owned enterprise, why isn't it reasonable to understand PDVSA, especially given the significance of its conduct, to the well-being of the nation, the whole purpose of this doctrine, to understand it to be a competent organ of the national executive.
Judge Robinson, under the Venezuelan Constitution, it is very clear that state-owned entities like PDVSA are not organs of the national executive. They're a completely distinct concept. Now, they are very important to the republic, and I'd like to address how the actual laws address that, but just to point you to the constitutional provisions that make that clear. Article 225 of the Constitution makes it clear that the national executive is the president, the vice president, and the cabinet ministers. That's Title 5 of the Constitution. The decentralized state-owned entities are governed by Article 6 of the Constitution, a whole different article. They have a different regime, different appointments, different powers, so they're very important. They're specifically provided for in the Constitution, but they're entirely distinct. And I haven't really heard PDVSA make the argument that it is itself the national executive as opposed to a decentralized entity. What I've heard it doing primarily is just denying that first part of the Andres Velasquez rule, not reading it out, the language on page 2116 about it needing to be an organ of the national executive and just going straight to the second requirement that it'd be important. But to address kind of the thrust of your question of this is really important, why shouldn't National Assembly be required? I think the key point there is that Article 150 is a constitutional floor. It applies to this particular category of contracts that is entered into by the national executive. It's a kind of separation of powers provision. But the National Assembly is fully empowered to require its own approval in additional cases. The power comes from Article 187, Section 1, that allows the National Assembly to legislate on matters of national importance, and it has done so. And this is a really important part that I think PDVSA's presentation has elided. Organic Law 98 actually requires the approval of the National Assembly for contracts of the Republic and other entities that would cover the central bank and decentralized entities. It specifically refers to decentralized entities. But then Article 101 exempts the central bank and it exempts PDVSA. That's Article 101.4. Under PDVSA's presentation, that law would be unconstitutional, and that is a really strange result. Instead, what happened here, and I think it's understandable, and the Bridget Acosta decision helps explain this, requiring National Assembly approval is a very unwieldy requirement. In a time of divided government, a state-owned entity might not be able to enter essential financing transactions, and so to make it more nimble, you might not want that requirement. There are many other checks, there are laws governing what kind of agreements PDVSA can enter, its board has to approve them and the like, but the requirement of National Assembly approval is not one the National Assembly itself has chosen to implement. And so they're trying to have this very broad reading of Article 150 that is contrary to what the court said in Andres Velasquez, and I think is contrary, and this is really significant, to 4 years of on-the-ground practice in Venezuela. There's not a single debt financing transaction, as you pointed out, Judge Robinson, by PDVSA that obtained National Assembly approval.
Well, are there any in which a majority stake in Citgo was pledged?
There was actually a transaction in 2003 that was secured by an interest in Citgo, and there was a transaction with Rosneft that pledged a 49.9% stake in Citgo.
Give me the sites to that. If not, that's okay. I'll find it if you have
okay.
You've been spewing record sites like you had them memorized.
I can get you those sites. But I do think the kind of rule and then they're positing is it's to be a national public interest contract. It requires the participation of the national executive unless it's a pledge for a majority interest in Citgo. I mean, that rule just goes to the importance and not to the participation of whom. I think all these transactions, many of which were very important.
Well, there are some national. You don't dispute that there are some state enterprises that do enter into national public interest contracts pursuant to the first sentence of Article 150. Is that right?
Decentralized entities.
Execution of national public.
So I think the first sentence of Article 150 is also talking about contracts of national public interest, so it is not talking about decentralized public entities.
Okay, but doesn't, for example, and I'm not going to get the article right, but to enter into a joint venture, right?
Yes.
That's something that requires, I had imagined that was an example of a case in which such requirement is determined by law.
Exactly, and I there are requirements, including for joint venture contracts. I do not think those come from the first sentence of Article 150.
Okay, those are independently required.
187.1, that authority to legislate on matters of national importance, that's where that comes from. And so I do think the term national public interest contract is consistent and always excludes decentralized entities. The constitutional authority to require approval by legislation comes from elsewhere. And it's true that PDVSA did require National Assembly approval for joint venture contracts pursuant to the hydrocarbons law that specifically requires it. But again, tens of billions of dollars of financing, I think it's really hard to say they were not important, over these 4 years have been obtained without National Assembly approval, and the National Assembly before this 2016 era never objected. And so I think it strains credulity to suggest that PDVSA could have just invalidated all those agreements at the drop of the pin, which is what his argument here requires. To turn to kind of the active state and comity issues, I was very surprised to see my friends starting with that argument. I think that argument was, those arguments were wrong for the reasons we described in the brief and some of the exchange this morning showed, but they really don't have a leg to stand on now in light of President Trump March 2026. Recognition of Delcy Rodriguez as the sole head of state able to take action on behalf of Venezuela.
What does that change anything?
So the first of all, the brief that was filed in this case was filed by the National Assembly. That's footnote one of that brief. The National Assembly no longer speaks by the Republic. So that is an amicus brief from the National Assembly, the non-recognized opposition branch that was neither recognized at the time of the events here, is not currently recognized. So I think that brief reserves particularly little weight. Now, I think that even if that recognition hadn't happened, the district court's animal science analysis was correct, and there are a lot of reasons to discount that brief. But given that it is no longer, it is not Delcy Rodriguez's brief until such time that the Republic of Venezuela comes in and files a new brief that says those arguments, animal science just falls out of this case.
So I've been struggling with this. Why isn't it the flip of what you just said? Why isn't it that we should presume that the Delcy Rodriguez administration stands by the brief filed on behalf of the Republic unless and until she comes in and tells us otherwise?
I think one of the factors under animal science is the role and authority of the entity you're hearing from. And that brief says it was filed by the National Assembly. It has extremely harsh words about President Delcy Rodriguez's administration, her party. And so I think it's very strange for this court to assume that Delcy Rodriguez has filed this brief when she hasn't and when it criticizes her own administration. And of course, that's an important piece of context in this case. The National Assembly's views were not the kind of unequivocal views of Venezuela at a certain point. This was always hotly disputed. And now the President of the United States has changed size, has changed the recognition, and
right.
So those views,
it's just hard to ask us to have our analysis driven by what we know is happening based on reading the newspapers when nobody has come into this litigation, neither the United States government nor the Venezuelan government, and said, hey, things have changed, or you should take into account these new considerations. That feels complicated to me.
That's a fair concern, Judge Robinson. I think that we've presented to you the official letter the United States filed in the Centel case, and so you have the recognition officially before you. But if that feels complicated to you, I don't need that. We're very happy to win just based on the arguments in the brief and under the recognition that existed at the time.
I guess I'm just wondering how much this really matters. I mean, it's a multi-factor analysis under vitamin C, is how I always think about it. Animal sciences, I guess it's people are calling it now. I don't know. I mean, when you have basically a government submitting various things in the course of litigation, supporting one side or the other, I thought the gist of the Supreme Court's decision there was to swat down our decision that we give particular deference. And we should, you know, respectfully read whatever we get, but we have to actually analyze the meat of what they say to us. And if they're not particularly authorized, but the meat is persuasive, then we're persuaded. But if they're speaking with great authority, but they're not particularly persuasive, we don't just trust them. And I thought that's why what we're forced to do is get into this hyper-detailed analysis of what the Constitutional Chamber has said and how that stacks up against the text of the provisions of the Constitution and whether there's a consensus among scholars about what it means. It seems to me that I don't know how much we ultimately, the case could turn one way or the other on the weight of who the speaker is, ultimately.
I agree with that entirely, Judge Nardini, and as your remand opinion in vitamin C illustrates, you start with a technical analysis of the law and the submissions, even if they were still, even if Delcy Rodriguez refiled the exact same brief, would only get the weight they warrant. There are a lot of reasons to discount them. I can march through those, but I do think the ultimate and simplest is that it just cannot be reconciled with Andres Velasquez, with how subsequent decisions have interpreted Andres Velasquez, with the views of the scholars, with the overwhelming body of past practice, with the text of the Constitution elsewhere, and I can talk about that, and with the other laws the National Assembly enacted and the President of Venezuela promulgated. And so given all of those things, the fact that one of the many views that the National Assembly has expressed is that this is unconstitutional and that brief cannot carry the day. And I think letting it carry the day would do exactly what the Supreme Court rejected in the animal science.
So can I shift to the active state argument? Because you look at the September 2016 resolution, and it specifically resolves to reject categorically that within the swap transaction, 50.1% of the shares comprising the capital stock of Citgo are offered as a guarantee with priority. Now, why isn't that an unequivocal statement of the then sovereign that A, our approval is needed, and B, we're not giving it?
Yes, Judge Robinson, I'd like to take that head on because I think the actual language of the resolution helps us. But I do want to note that there are many ways we can win on active state, and I think extraterritoriality is probably the simplest way to write the opinion. But I think another way we could win is that the September 2016 resolution did not view itself as invalidating the exchange. That resolution invokes control functions under Article 187. That is referring to the 187.3 authority. That's an investigative power to start an investigation and to obtain evidence. It does not significantly say that the exchange is a national public interest contract. It does not assert the power to approve or withhold approval, and it does not declare it void. It does not do what the 2019 resolution did, which is say is unconstitutional. And I think the contrast to the language of that resolution is important. Also, the 2019 resolution itself does not say that's what the May 2016 resolution did. It said that it was the basis of the investigation. And after the investigation...
When you just said May, did you mean September?
Sorry, September.
Okay.
I mean September, yes. I apologize. So September 2016. It was the basis of that investigation. Only upon that investigation did the National Assembly conclude it was a national public interest contract. That's 2019. We all agree that 2019 cannot be that.
But it doesn't say we're considering rejecting it and we want to do an investigation. They say we categorically reject. You may go ahead with your swap, but not... You can't pledge Citgo. Why isn't that a fairly direct instruction precisely as to that?
I agree with you. The National Assembly emphatically condemned the swap. It rejected it categorically. But in the context of that 187.3 control power, that's the predicate for the investigation. We really disagree with this. We really don't like this. We might not have the power to stop it, but we don't like it. We're going to start an investigation. We're going to decide what we do. I think it's like a House resolution, you know, condemning President Biden for the withdrawal out of Afghanistan or President Obama for a particular prisoner swap. The House can say it. They can mean it. They can express condemnation or rejection. But absent an invocation of a power to actually invalidate the deal, that's all it is, and it's not something that warrants active state deference.
That may be true as to the constitutional argument, but when we get into the active state argument, it gets a little murkier, right? Because the National Assembly isn't just, at that juncture, one of multiple branches of government expressing views that it's powerless to, you know, effectuate. It is the sovereign as far as our laws are concerned. And it's saying this isn't okay. Why isn't that a different scenario?
No, Judge Robinson. So I disagree with the premise that at the time it was the sovereign. At the time, Maduro was the recognized sovereign, and that's a really important principle. Whatever you think about retroactive recognition, when the recognized sovereign, you cannot undo the actions of the actual recognized sovereign because parties rely on that. Guarantee Trust has a really helpful explanation about how Americans should be able to rely on their president's recognition. So even if the recognition has some retroactive effects, it cannot contradict the fact that Maduro was the one in charge, and it was, to the eyes of the markets, to the eyes of the counterparties, just the view of the minority view. But I think that even
if
you
had... Don't we have cases, though, where they're like civil wars or something, and it's not really till at the end of the day when we recognize the winner that we do look back retroactively? Isn't this a little bit like a civil war?
So I guess I would start with what's sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander principle from the last argument, which is if you think that recognitions are retroactive, then the Delcy Rodriguez recognition should be retroactive. And again, that means that the National Assembly was just speaking as the minority of the government, not the sovereign, able to take action.
But well, she hasn't filed anything here saying that. I mean, I kind of surmise that she wants, it's hard for me to imagine that she wants to lose CITGO.
But the National Assembly's resolution as the opposition party has now been kind of reinstated to the resolution of an opposition party, because the National Assembly is not the recognized sovereign at this time. It's not the recognized
sovereign.
Right,
I get that. What's hard is that we don't have anything filed in the record that sort of would give us the hook to do that. I mean, maybe read the newspapers and that's enough, but...
And I guess to get to the first part of your honors question, the reason that it's important to read what the resolution actually did very precisely is that the active state is a very potent doctrine. It says that even if the Venezuelan Constitution did not give the National Assembly this role, because the National Assembly was, I'll grant you for purposes of this answer, the sovereign at the relevant time, then it's actually still Trump, even though that was not the rule of Venezuela. And in order to kind of police the boundaries of this doctrine, I think this Court's Celestine decision, the Supreme Court's Kirkpatrick decision has been very disciplined about how to apply that doctrine, and coming in after the fact to language that says we reject this in the sense that we condemn it, we don't like it, but does not say we deem it unconstitutional and void, to give that a trump card in this litigation, I think would go beyond how this Court and the Supreme Court views the active state doctrine. But you can avoid all this just by ruling on extraterritoriality, because the situs here was plainly in the United States. The agreement was signed in New York as an obligation to pay a debt in New York in U.S. dollars.
Petavese's approval of the transaction, did that happen? Which was kind of the first thing that's necessary to give the bonds validity. Did that happen? Where did that happen?
The signature pages were exchanged in New York. You know, the internal board approval probably occurred in Venezuela. But of course, the extraterritoriality test is the transaction entirely extraterritorial? And I think that this is an Allied Bank is on all fours here, where there were Costa Rican state-owned banks that had certain obligations. But because the obligation was to be paid in New York in U.S. dollars, the court said that it was unequivocally based in New York. And here, the physical collateral, CITGO itself, is also held in New York. So the idea that changing the ownership of CITGO, which is physically located in New York, is fully a taking within Venezuela, does not make a lot of sense.
Okay. I don't think there are any other questions for the panel. So thank you very much. We have your argument. Why don't we hear from Mr. Gottlieb and then Mr. Timofeyev. We are going to hold you to 2 minutes pretty tightly.
Thank you, Your Honor. One point about comedy and then about the act of state. The Republic has explained why the entire discussion that just occurred about Andres Velasquez is incorrect from the Republic's view. No one in Venezuela, as the Republic has explained in 5 different submissions, understands Andres Velasquez to mean what our friends suggest that it means. Not the recognized National Assembly, not the Maduro regime's National Assembly, and not the Maduro regime itself, which has repeatedly submitted for approval to the National Assembly contracts involving state-owned entities. This is why it was widely understood at the time that there was a significant validity issue. This is why less than 40% of the bondholders participated in the exchange, because there was a significant risk to validity. This was understood at the time. It was understood in the press. This court, in fact, recognized that in the VR Global decision. Affirming the decision below would be essentially telling. the Republic of Venezuela, you do not understand your own constitution. You think you have the power to review these transactions that you've listed out, and it is not just the pledge of Citgo. It is the Rosneft pledge that my friend mentioned that the Republic has applied its Article 150 powers to and invalidated. That would be invalidated under their view. It is the
When was that?
That was executed at the same time as this pledge, and it's laid out in Ambassador Vecchio's brief. The Rosneft pledge was at around the same time as this pledge transaction, and the National Assembly asserted its authorities over that pledge and declared it null and void. I want to address the active state issues. The September resolution most certainly does not cite Article 187 third. That is a fabrication. Page A115, specifically the third provision of the resolution, cites Articles 187 Section 9, which is the precise approval authority under Article 150 of the Constitution. Then with respect to the recognition changing the way to the National Assembly, this gets the law backwards. Banco de España answers this question. It is precisely addresses a situation where you have a recognized sovereign that changes during the course of the litigation. It is the sovereign that is recognized and extant at the time of suit under Banco de España, under Sabatino, and under this court's decision in Kanilawaf that determines the sovereign that speaks for purposes of the active state doctrine and the doctrine of international comity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Timofeyev.
Thank you, Anna. Two quick rebuttal points. On Article 150, the National Assembly resolutions which approved joint venture contracts by PDVSA affiliates and non-decentralized entities expressly invoke Article 150 as the basis for approval. One example is Appendix 5360. And the predicate authority for the National Assembly's ability to require such approval in the hydrocarbons law, in the law and financial administration, is that these contracts be national public interest contracts. It's the same way in which the US Congress can pass a law regulating interstate commerce, but cannot designate the growing of wheat in the backyard to be interstate commerce and then proceed to regulate it. Second point, Chechnya, didn't you ask, how do we know that Andres Velasquez was not reaching the question of decentralized entities' ability to enter national public interest contract? We know it from the Republic Semica's brief, which explained that that's what Andres Velasquez's decision mean. We know it from the opinions by Venezuelan scholars, Professor Belen Madrid at Appendix 1807, Professor Duke Corridor at Appendix 3251 explained that Andres Velasquez was not reaching that issue. National Assembly commissioned a legal opinion when it was considering the exchange by Professor Carmona. This is a docket, District Court's docket 181-8 at pages 436, 440, summarized at Appendix 303-05. He expressly said, notwithstanding Andres Velasquez, decentralized entities can enter national public interest contracts, and these contracts with foreign counterparties have to be submitted to the National Assembly. And he expressly said the contract mortgage in Citgo, the ownership of Citgo, is such a contract that has to go to the National Assembly. The other, actually, my colleague on the other side addressed section, addressed Article 101 and 38 of the financial law, which was at issue in Andres Velasquez. In fact, Article 101 exempted certain contracts by decentralized entities such as the central bank and the PDVSA from the requirement of submission. That article would have been redundant if, in fact, the Article 150 did not, categorically did not extend to those entities. In addition to Rosneft, National Assembly also passed a resolution rejecting the Maduro's mortgaging of the assignment of certain claims in the PDVSA litigation trust, which sought to privatize important claims owned by PDVSA. National Assembly passed a resolution rejecting that. In fact, the Republic submitted a similar amicus letter on an appeal to the 11th Circuit, making exactly the same point, that that decision by PDVSA was invalid because not authorized by the National Assembly.
Thank you to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Let me just say, with respect to all the counsel on both sides, it was a very helpful briefing and excellent argument. So however this case comes out, compliments to you all. We will now turn to the final case on the argument calendar for today, which is 25-794, Sue Costello versus Paramount Global, Inc. And we'll let the courtroom, everybody come and go and get settled before we start. Thank you. just let them all file out so we can hear you all without any distractions. Okay. Ms. Costello, you may begin, and as you have seen through some of the other arguments today, I understand you'd like to reserve a minute for rebuttal. So that means after your initial presentation, we'll hear from the other side, but then you get to come back up for a minute if there's anything you feel you would usefully respond to. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Sue Costello. I am pro se appellant, and this appeal rests on three undisputed facts. First, the failure to test the threshold. The district court fundamentally denied my due process by choking my ability to present fraud in the inducement. The court was required to test this threshold the moment I challenged the making of the agreement. The judge opened the door to viability on the record, but when the appellees said the deal could still be opened, she never held them to the facts. Two, the EFAA trigger. This case was filed in 2023 and is protected by the EFAA under the Second Circuit's ruling Oliveri versus Stifel. Under the continuing violation doctrine, a hostile environment claim reoccurs with every new act in the patent. The harassment here continued on April 5th, 2022, at the New York Attorney General's office, where they attempted to bribe me into a Me Too payout to bury the contract crime. The district judge's own actions are part of this ongoing hostile environment. She sexualized me on the record and put sexual words in my mouth to block me from mentioning the fraud and the EFA continuing acts. She then tampered with the transcript to sanitize the record with bizarre changes like Ronan Farrow to Rona Barrett. I formally identified the sexualization, the choking of my fraud, and the EFA claim, and the judicial bias to the magistrate. Because these successive acts occurred after the March 3rd, 2022 effective date, the arbitration clause is void by operation of law under 9 USC 402. The arbitration clause was procured as a criminal tool to preemptively bypass the court. This exact abuse is why the EFA was enacted to stop. And the third legal impossibility, the district court issued an arbitration order specifically to strip me of my EFA protections and property rights. It then dismissed the case with prejudice for failure to arbitrate, despite the fact that JAMS had twice stated on the record that the case belongs in court due to the underlying crimes. Under the doctrine of prevention, the appellees cannot benefit from the failure that they themselves created. By engineering a fraudulent scheme, they made the arbitration both legally and practically impossible. This is not a mere error. It is fraud upon the court. The court must vacate the judgment to protect the sanctity of the judicial system. I ask that the court strike their pleadings, enter a default judgment, and refer these criminal matters to the proper authorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Costello. Why don't we now hear from the other side? I understand for the appellee, with Ms. Weeks, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Crystal Weeks of Weil, Gottschall & Manges on behalf of Appellee Paramount Global. I want to take a step back and focus on the narrow legal issue that is before the court, which is whether it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to dismiss Ms. Costello's case for failure to prosecute. It clearly was not. After the district court entered an order compelling arbitration and staying the case, more than a year passed without Ms. Costello taking the steps to initiate her arbitration. She was given five warnings that failure to commence arbitration would result in dismissal of her case. She received three extensions of her deadline to do so, and ultimately she received a show cause order, and still Ms. Costello did not commence arbitration. Even affording her the solicitude she's entitled as a pro se litigant, the district court was well within its discretion under this court's Rule 41B analysis to dismiss the case. And I'm happy to tick through those factors quickly, Your Honors, on duration. Again, this case was stalled for more than a year on the docket. This court has previously held that as little as a few months is sufficient delay. On notice, she received five separate warnings that failure to commence arbitration would result in dismissal. This court has held that one warning is sufficient. The district court also reasonably balanced management of its docket with giving Ms. Costello an opportunity to be heard. She was heard at every turn. She filed 33 letters to the district court, 7 of those after the report and recommendation. She was heard at an in-person conference, another status conference, and she's being heard here today. She has not been denied her due process rights. In terms of prejudice, Your Honors, the court was entitled to presume prejudice from the length of the delay. And finally, it was clear that no lesser sanction would be effective when she was warned that failure to commence arbitration would result in dismissal, and she did not do so. Now, Ms. Costello has made several arguments here today. None of those change the Rule 41B analysis, Your Honors. With respect to the EFAA, the court heard and rejected that argument. The facts underlying Ms. Costello's arguments all arose prior to enactment of that statute, which does not apply retroactively.
Can I just ask a question about that? I was just thinking through, because normally court says arbitrate. You don't get to appeal until you've gone through the arbitration and you come back for confirmation, and eventually you can get here. But it strikes me that that requirement might create some real policy tensions in the context of somebody who has a plausible EFAA claim, because you're essentially requiring them to do exactly the thing that statute is designed to not require them to do. Is there any other step that somebody in that situation can take when they're caught in that bind and they assert an EFAA claim? Is there can they seek interlocutory appeal, seek mandamus? Like, or are they stuck going through the arbitration and then appealing in due course?
So, Your Honor, typically under this court's precedent, an interlocutory order in this case would not merge with the final judgment because of the sanction of failure to prosecute. But I think in a situation where that weren't the case, it may be possible to seek interlocutory appeal. But here, you know, Ms. Costello has not even alleged a hostile work environment claim. And again, all the facts were alleged prior to enactment. And yes, if you were to appeal an arbitration order, that would be at the end of the road after the arbitration, and then you would have the opportunity to appeal, which Ms. Costello would have been able to do had she gone to arbitration as ordered. She could have made the argument she made here today on appeal of that decision at that point in time. And I just want to say in closing, Your Honors, that there are a number of motions pending before the court. Paramount rests on the papers on those. We ask that they be denied, and for the reasons discussed today and in our brief, we ask the court to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Costello, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. If there's anything that opposing counsel said that you think would be useful to respond to, this is your opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did try to commence arbitration. JAMS, a designated arbitrator, refused to do it 3 or 4 times. They told me that they couldn't do it because of the underlying crimes. That is all in my appeal. I was not allowed to argue any of that because I was choked on the first call. The judge choked me on the first call before I could even mention her ex-firm. She was a partner in the firm that did their private investigation. I was about to mention it. I was about to mention the continuing act with the AG, and she put sexual words in my mouth. She said, did you make sexual allegations? You didn't say things like those things happened to me. You didn't hear that other people, you didn't say that you heard other people did it. You didn't say sexual allegations. She said it so aggressively and attacked me so aggressively that I had to say no, no, never, never, even after the first time that I said no. And the reason why I needed extensions in my to get to the jams while the court was choking me is because both my father and my brother died during this. That's why I needed the extensions, Your Honor. So my letter 28 proves that they made the contract through the back channels, the same sexual back channels that they made, that the New York AG's assurance said that they were making back deals with women about sex, and that's the same way that they made my deal. That's the EFA complaint. That's the EFA complaint. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Costello. We appreciate the arguments of both parties. As with every case that we heard today, we will take the case under advisement. That means that at some point in the future, there will be a written ruling that issues from the court. This court, having completed the business for which it was today convened, will now stand adjourned. Thank you all.
Court stands adjourned.